So one thing I want to tell you guys about the conference before we get into our show.
Yeah. You are a podcast movement.
I am a podcast movement. It's been going great. And like the buzz that everyone's talking about here is a couple sessions that they've had on AI. And it's people are like excited on one end. And I think everything you've been trying to convince me of, I'm now getting it a little bit more because they're saying it's not a tool to create your podcast, but it's a tool for promotion. And once they kind of like phrased it that way, it made more sense because people are apparently taking transcripts of their show and being like, make 5 social media posts for this or make a newsletter out of this. And so they're kind of using like, you know, you do the work and then you funnel that into the ChatGPT and it does all of the, you know, the social media crap for you. Yeah. So that's how people are excited. But we were also told that we, because we speak on the internet, are sitting ducks for the scams that are going to be coming. Like the ones where you use my voice and call my mom and say, mom, I've been kidnapped. I need $50,000. And so they're encouraging like, not just podcasters, but like everyone, but especially podcasters to have a safe word with everyone, you know, so that when that call comes, you can say the word and that's how, you know, you can prove that you're a real person.
Well, you could not, somebody else would not know that my safe word is pink elephant. So what you don't want to do is say it out loud.
Well, of course.
Because then they could use it, otherwise.
Well, and the other thing you have to keep in mind too, is when you establish the safe word, don't have your phone near you since that's a little AI robot itself.
Yeah, that's a good call. And I'm going to make my parents don't give me money safe word different than my sex safe word. Cause I feel like that's, I just don't want to connect those two things.
Don't do it. Yeah. It'd be awkward.
It'd be weird.
If you mixed them up.
And then like, I don't want to, I don't want to go into the scenarios here, but by the way, Jen, loving this smoky voice, you should yell more.
This is straight from talking. We didn't even do karaoke last night. Like we just didn't have our annual party. So yeah, this is just chit chatting and I still haven't been on stage yet. So they're getting the raspy version of me today.
On a more macro level on AI, I believe I've reached a Zen state. I felt very proud of this because I was talking to some friends and they were like, no, AI is going to, it's a huge deal. It might be the extinction of mankind. And I was like, I'm just not that worried about it. And they're like, you should be worried about it. And I was like, okay, but if I'm worried about it, what could I do in my life to brace myself? And they're like, nothing. And I was like, well, then I'm not going to get worried about it. It sounds like what I need to do is stay not worried as long as I possibly can before the shit hits the fan. There's no benefit to me being worried at all. No, you're an idiot. Like I'm going to remain in my cocoon of naivete if it's going to be the same outcome.
Yeah, I was in one of the conversations where like people were like, this is terrifying. And my friend Ryan is just like super chill about it. I'm like, how are you so chill about all this? And he's like, with every new technology, we'll just adapt. We'll be fine. Mm. And I think he's right. I mean, we've been freaking out about tech. Remember Y2K? We were fine.
Y2K. No, novels. Back in the day, novels. there were articles being written in like the London Times that these newfangled novels were going to make the younger generation fabulists and pull them away from, like people were worried about novels at one point in history as being destructive to the fabric of civilization. Bicycles were scary. There used to be a thing called elevator disease. I'm not making it was thing called elevator disease where I can understand people being freaked out by elevators because it's a room that goes up into other rooms. That's weird, right? But like people thought they had a disease from going in an elevator too fast. It was like a diagnosed. It was all bullshit.
Yeah.
They were like freaking out about this stuff.
People are dumb.
Power lines. There's like these amazing old diagrams, like scare cartoons of what's going to happen in a world with power lines that we are all just birds are dead and children have it wrapped around their necks and stuff like that. But
well, to be fair, they started the fire in Lahaina, so they weren't exactly wrong. And paradise, like our power lines are a fucking problem.
Well, so that
they were on to something.
Paradise gets it. Paradise gets into one of my least favorite topics, which is the power utilities of Northern California, not upkeeping their equipment. Yes, it is dangerous equipment. And if you don't upkeep it, although I don't know, I've been seeing some very, very interesting videos about direct energy weapons in Maui. Have you seen any of these?
Yeah, these conspiracy theories are annoying actually, because these are solvable problems. And so if we're talking nonsense, I don't think it helps anything.
I think this makes a lot of sense. If I were a deranged government with an energy weapon, of course, my top priority would be Maui. That's definitely what I would fire it at. It wouldn't be Washington or New York if I was going to try to cripple America. As we all know, the Achilles heel of the American economy is Maui for deranged lunatic governments.
Well, even in Hawaii, Pearl Harbor is one island over. So maybe the military base.
Two on the nose, though. Come on. Think like a writer, Jen.
Fool us once. Shame on us. Fool us twice. Shame on. Yeah. Wait, I can't remember how it works. Either way, we should go to war with Japan if they have one of these energy weapons. Either way, just to make sure.
Yeah.
They'd be way easier to knock off this time.
Speaking of war, news from Edinburgh. The local penguin at the zoo, Sir Nils, has been promoted to brigadier general in the Norwegian army. Every
Jesus
time
Christ.
The king swings through town, they give him a new title. I think it's bullshit. I also can't fucking fly, but I can drive a car and podcast and shit. And I don't have any of these titles. I've never been made any military member in any military in the world. This goddamn bird, every time I'm here, is beating me. Every time I'm here, I look at my resume and I'm like, the bird's doing better than me. Anyway, fuck you, Norway.
You are such an eccentric that I could only imagine that you wake up resplendent in your nightwear only to have a specially crafted Heat and Times brought to you by a badger wearing a monocle. And that's the top, like, just screaming headline, three columns, badger promoted to brigadier general. And you just slam your coffee on it. Not again.
There's some truth there. There's a lot going on there. Yeah.
From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young. From Edinburgh, Scotland,
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And from Aurora, Colorado,
I'm Jen Briney.
And we're not wrong on this edition of the podcast. Pursuant to Jen being at a conference, we're going to talk about COVID's resurgence and whether or not we are going to see a return of mitigation factors. The beginning and possibly end of the Republican primary debates are tonight. As we record this, we discuss whether or not they are worthwhile at all. Jen, podcast movement happens twice a year.
Well, so they have smaller conferences, but there's only one big one every year.
The
big one happens in the summer. Next summer is going to be in Washington, D.C., actually, August 19th through 22nd. So
what could possibly could be happening then in D.C. in August?
So that's right up my wheelhouse. I don't think I'll be missing that one.
That'll be popping. Well, let's talk about this. Are you afraid of getting COVID at this conference? Because I got to tell you, I just came back from DEF CON and the entire Hack 5 crew, except for me and one other person, got COVID. It is going around. Are you afraid?
No, not at all. And the rooms here are pretty big. I like to spend time outside. So last night I was outdoors most of the time. The party tonight is outdoors. But I also, like, I've had COVID. I survived it. I'm vaccinated. There are some people wearing masks here. So I assume they either are being cautious for other people's sake, which I really appreciate when people do that, or they're nervous about it and they're wearing N95. So there's a way to protect ourselves. So, no, I'm not. I haven't thought about it at all until you brought it up.
Well, part of the reason is because three new COVID-19 variants, including a highly mutated strain, are spreading across the United States. Hospitalizations at this point are below past peaks, but numbers are increasing. Health officials believe existing tests and upcoming vaccines will be effective against most variants, but uncertainty remains around the highly mutated strain. The current prominent variants are EG5, accounting for 20.6 of new infections, FL1.5.1 at 13.3. Both are descendants of the XBB strain. The fall 2023 vaccine boosters are expected to work against the prevalent variants, although BA286's impact still remains uncertain. This has led to a fear of lockdown era restrictions returning. The Hollywood Reporter has reported that Lionsgate Studios are now requesting employees begin to mask up in the office again. Andrew Heaton, I ask you this. If we do see a return of meaningful COVID numbers. What metrics, if any, should we gauge to guide any mitigation measures, specifically from a governmental perspective?
I'm done. I think I'm done. I was told we were going to have one once in a lifetime pandemic, and I participated in that. I wore masks. I got vaccinated. I wasn't like fiery on either end, but I wasn't like, never, ever will I ever wear, like, yeah, I'd wear a mask and stuff. But we were doing that for this one time thing. And now in retrospect, when I look at it, I think I probably should have been a bit more incredulous to a lot of the claims that were made. I'm not saying that it wasn't a big deal or that I regret getting a vaccine or anything like that. But when I look at a lot of the measures that were put in place, like, my understanding is that New York and Florida had pretty similar death counts at the end of the day, despite the fact that New York had way more draconian lockdowns than Florida did, which would indicate it was just for fun. Australia played this late. They stayed locked down for a very long time. They did manage to have a lower mortality rate because they waited until the vaccine had come out before they lifted that lockdown. So they were under lockdown for, like, you know, 2 years, and they couldn't leave the country or come in. And it did have an effect. They had a lower rate of death. But when you average it out, it was kind of an average of about a week and a half per year that everybody would get, which is one of the metrics that government agencies use to measure effects. So you either do it in days average saved of a life or money saved. Those tend to be the two metrics. And I don't know. I don't have much fire in my belly for it at this point. I'm here at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, where, unlike the spacious, well air conditioned conference rooms that you two have been enjoying in the United States, I've been in a series of very drippy basements that look like a dungeon underneath a moldering old city where we're all crammed in together with a bunch of drunks. It's absolutely a recipe for, and everybody's coughing and everybody's hacking, and I'm still there, and nobody's wearing a mask either. So, like, if you want to, I'll never give anybody a hard time for wearing a mask if they want to do it. And if you're coughing or hacking and you wear a mask, bless you. I would really prefer everybody bring a mask on a plane if they are with a cold or COVID or anything like that. But however bad it gets, I don't think that there's a lot of oomph left in this. I mean, I from where I'm at, this seems like we now have annual flu season for COVID, and that's going to keep happening. And there's going to be different variations the same way we do for the flu. And it seems to me that the benefit is we can actually get tested for it. I've been tested 3 times since I came to the United Kingdom. I've tested negative every time. I think it's possible I actually had COVID at the beginning of the trip. I'm not really sure, but I'm testing negative now, but I can at least know. So I think that this is just kind of a regular thing now. And we live in a world with vaccines and where we've already been through this. So I don't know.
This is an amazing moment. Dear listener, I want you to just crystallize this in your mind, because you are seeing the fact that within Andrew Heaton, there are two wolves. There's one, the systems thinker, who wants nothing but data so he can guide a better populace. And then there is two, the extrovert, who desperately, desperately fears that he will be locked in a closet for another year and a half. Yeah. And this is the battle. And right now, the extrovert is winning, because I asked you what metrics, and you didn't even give me any metrics. Not hospitalizations, not deaths, not anything. You are just, for the love of God, do not put me back under the bed.
Yeah. Well, to be clear on that, if, like, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think there's any political will for it. But let's say theoretically that there's some attempt to have, like, a state by state or city by city lockdown. I would just leave. I would just go. So I'm not going to participate in that. And I might, like, you know, hole up in a cabin with some friends or something like that. But I'm not going to be doing lockdown solo again. That's just not going to occur.
So that was, you experienced lockdown in Los Angeles, which resulted in about a year's worth of deep, dark depression and a book of poetry that hit number one.
Yep. Number one on poetry on Amazon. I am, at this point in my life, a more accomplished poet than I am comedian, pundit, lover, all those things. I really knocked it out of the park. Los Angeles is hideous. Poems of an ugly city. If you haven't heard of this book, listeners, absolutely do yourself a favor. Buy Los Angeles is hideous. Poems of an ugly city, because it truly is an ugly city. That was a nice thing to come out of it. But I would take that year of my life back if I could.
Jen, since Heaton is avoiding the question, are there any metrics that you think would guide any sort of governmental decisions on mitigation?
Deaths and full hospitals. I do feel like when you get to the point, like, I don't think we're going to get there with COVID because we do have the vaccines. They're studying this more than anything else. So I'm not afraid of that with COVID in particular, but I'm thinking of, you know, the movie Contagion. I do think it's possible we could have another pandemic with something that is actually far more deadly. And when I'm looking at, like, would I ever be okay with another lockdown again, knowing that the ones that we had, I mean, especially as someone who was in Los Angeles for the meat of it, like, I didn't leave LA until summer of 2021.
And never hung out with me at any point in LA. We didn't know each other yet, but still.
Yeah, we did, I think.
No, I didn't interview you till I was in Oakland and you were in San Francisco.
No, I had already left.
Yeah, this was before. And also, to be fair, you didn't know Heaton, and it was pretty cramped while he was weeping alone in his bathtub with a full bottle of wine.
My signature meal was eating Oreos out of a vase with a ladle.
The master of my COVID bubble was pretty strict, so I wouldn't have been allowed to hang out with you. What the hell were we talking about? Oh, yeah.
Full hospitals.
Yeah, there was a point there where hospitals were full. And that's a real problem that I feel like that would be my metric. But that said, I don't think we're going to get there. Like, we keep hearing about all the different strains, like, oh, a different strain is going to take over the Omicron strain. It's like, is it a strain that's killing us more? Unless the answer is yes, then I don't give a crap about XB155 or whatever combination of letters and numbers they're throwing at us now. I'll probably get the booster because I do feel like for my own personal calculus, I think COVID was really unpleasant. And so if it can make it better for the next time I get it, like, okay, fine. I don't think the vaccine hype about the vaccines being dangerous for your health, I don't think the science or the data is actually backing that up. So I'll probably get a booster. But other than that, I'm also kind of done with COVID.
I think that's well put, Jen. I think if everybody remembers, despite serious attempts to black it out from memory, both using psychological suppression and mass amounts of alcohol, if you remember back to the beginning of the pandemic during hashtag flatten the curve, the idea at the time was, look, if we have hospitals so full that people are being turned away, we're going to have unnecessary deaths, which is what we're trying to avoid here. We're not going to be able to avoid the actual onslaught of people that are going to die from a pandemic. But what we can do is slow it enough that medical resources can deal with them a pace and not have unnecessary deaths. I think that is a reasonable metric to use. But like you, Jen, I don't think it's going to happen with COVID, given that we've already got herd immunity based on multiple definitions, Fauci revised, and the vaccines. But theoretically, yeah, maybe if something else happened.
Yeah, the one thing that I have heard that I would be upset about, and I am upset about actually as someone who goes there, but I believe it was In-N-Out that put in a policy where their employees are not allowed to wear masks unless they get a doctor's note. And that is one policy that I'm not okay with, because I feel like at this point we should be making our individual safety decisions. And if someone wants to put on a mask, whether to protect themselves or if they feel a cold coming on and they want to protect everyone who's eating in the restaurant, I feel like they should have the ability to do that. So there has been this backlash against lockdowns and masking and all of that stuff. I don't want to see any policies being put in place that prevent people from protecting themselves. And we actually are seeing that. So that's one thing that I'll actively fight against.
Far be it from me to criticize Jen for promoting individual freedom. I agree with you again.
He agrees with you animal style on that point. You know, I am very curious to see how this breaks down politically, because there is an absolute crowd for mitigations and lockdowns. And it is often people that have large houses and probably don't leave their house all that much, and or hypochondriacs in general. And that is the one thing for which culturally I would desperately like to never have happen again in my lifetime, which is turning over our culture to the hypochondriacs. And I was there for the moment when it happened. Lockdown was something that was very painful for me. That was not a great time. I desperately hated the fact that it robbed me from the ability for the first time ever to go travel the presidential trail as an independent journalist, which was what I was building up to do in 2020. And then was obliterated because of the pandemic, but I'm here to be safe. I personally have a pretty strong immune system. I'm lucky to have it. I don't know why that is the case, but I don't get sick all that often. When I got COVID, it was not all that bad. So I am personally fine doing whatever, but I do not want to turn over the entirety of our government and culture and media to the people that are the most panicked about every illness always, and have them guide everything.
Yeah. On that note, looking back on it, I wasn't like hard, like I'm a proceduralist in favor of individual rights, but I'm also a utilitarian that wants to be guided by data, right? Some of the similar thing that you mentioned. So I had conflicting inner opinions on mask mandates and lockdown. I wasn't 100% on either camp, but when I look back on that, I think that for everybody, that was such a stressful time period that a lot of the time that fear and anger would manifest an incredible hostility to other people. So, like in Oklahoma, where I'm from, there was a fucking shooting at a McDonald's because a guy was told he had to wear a mask, and he decided it would be better to shoot somebody than to put a mask on. Even if you're in the anti-mask crowd, I think we can all agree that was going too far. Conversely, one of my friends in Austin, he didn't get vaccinated. He got absolutely walloped by COVID. I mean, near death, was intubated and was presumed to die. And the doctor who believed he was dying came in to scold him for not taking the vaccine. So that is to say, Jesus. A doctor who believed the last conversation he would have with a dying man felt obliged to take time out of his schedule to come in and berate him. And like that, however that manifests, that feeling, I don't like. And then I'll add to that, that I think that there is a certain personality type that it self-soothes by making everybody be on the same page. Whatever that is, like we've all decided that on campus on Friday, we're going to wear purple shirts. I don't really like wearing. We've decided we're wearing purple shirts, and it's this kind of like, I think the world's chaotic and hellish, and maybe this illusion of control. If I can exert control over other people to make everybody do what the group wants, the conformity, then it gives me a sense of being able to have some traction in the universe. And I look back and I see more of that than I saw at the time.
So politically, do you believe, I was going to say one of our two major parties, but let's just say the Democrats, do you think that we will see that become a signal to some of them, some of their voting base, for which would be more into mitigation factors, that we will see Biden or Kamala be wearing masks, or a reason why they are not going to do as many events in person?
I don't think so. I mean, most of the people that were most afraid of COVID, at least that I know, that were pretty extreme about it, with the exception of like one journalist that I know who's still like COVID panicked. Most people are also back to living their normal lives. I don't think it's to bring back COVID, especially when hospitals are not full and we're not having friends who are young, who are being intubated. Like, people know whether or not this is affecting them. And unless it gets to that point, I don't think that it's politically advantageous to pretend that COVID's coming back in some kind of like scary way. Like, they're trying to move beyond all that. And so I don't even think the Democrats think that would be a good move, although the Democrats tend to do stupid things that you wouldn't expect them to do. So
even if it's an excuse to take Biden off the road so he doesn't fall asleep at another dinner where he's trying to comfort the victims of Maui.
I know, but I think they'll just take him off the road anyway, because their strategy seems to be, oh, we're going to run around against Trump again and just say that he's awful. And that's it. Like, Biden doesn't have to run in a primary or really run at all. He's just anointed by the Democrats. So I don't think that's going to be a problem for them. They'll just put him back in the basement regardless of if they have a COVID excuse.
That's wild. That just that is like a statement for which is said by somebody whose opinion I trust is crazy, that a presidential candidate is so sure they are going to win that they will not run their candidate. That is kind of kooky.
But am I wrong?
I assume you are, because I don't think anyone would be that stupid. Like,
but there's
I
no primary and like,
well, there's never a primary for a sitting president. Number one, as much as people are upset with Biden or lukewarm on Biden, the love is not there. However you want to break that down, no matter what, you don't have to run in a primary if you are the sitting president. That's just them's the breaks. Yeah. Unless other people want to step up that have a lot of money and influence and run against you. If a Pete or a Kamala ran against him, then all hell has broken loose because he doesn't have control of his own party. And that's a different conversation. But in general, you don't have to do it. You should have a top-down control. But he's also old and he fell asleep and he told one of his patented Joe Biden, it's almost assuredly a lie, stories about how, you know, his garage burnt down and almost burnt his Corvette amongst.
Did fucking Corn Pop burn down his garage? That son of a bitch. Corn
they
Pop.
They actually found. They found an article and it was a small fire in his kitchen. So it wasn't even anywhere near the Corvette nice. Either. It's like, but Biden's always been like this. Well, so yes. people Hold think on. It's because he's old. Like, no, he's no. always been the king of bullshit.
To his credit, he used to plagiarize. He used to be, he was plagiarizing yes. people rather than just fabricating things wholesale. But he does have a track record for that. That was, I think, why he dropped out in one of the third iteration of his presidential campaigns.
I want to say it was like in the 80s or 90s. Or something.
His first one, he dropped out for plagiarizing.
Yeah.
The second one, he dropped out. That was the Obama one where he called him clean and nice. And then then the third one was the charm. He became president of the United States of America on the back of a pandemic that crippled the world and society and the economy.
Yeah. And Biden doesn't have that to run on this time. And he can't gaffe as much or fall asleep in much in public. So I think they're going to do the exact same thing they did in 2020 and just hide him.
He one time I was covering him in South Carolina, one of the last trips before the pandemic hit. And he told a story about how his dad went to a Christmas party. He was working at a car dealership and the owner of the car dealership during the Christmas party had a bucket and threw a bunch of silver dollars onto the dance floor and people were picking them up. And that Biden's dad was so mad that he grabbed his wife and they went home and that's where young Joey was. And he woke Joey up and he said, Joey, never let a man throw money at you. And I'm like, I'm sure that this is horseshit. Like I have no doubt that this is entirely made up, but I don't even really get the point because yeah. somebody, especially back in what 1950, whenever this is supposed to be, if Joe Biden is a young boy, like throwing dollars out on the dance floor just sounds like a fun thing that would happen at a super lit Pennsylvania Christmas party.
A lot of fucking money too. I'll dance for you right now. It's about $20 for the spot price on silver. You start throwing fucking silver down, I'll dance like a monkey for you.
My entire business model is throw money at yeah, me.
We're buskers. We're literally buskers. It's what we do. We just do it digitally.
Maybe okay. I was like, what the fuck are you even talking about? What is going on?
I had a theory for a while that Trump was actually Andy Kaufman doing the greatest possible character sketch ever. Now I'm wondering if Biden's really Garrison Keillor, where he just wanders up to a mic and goes, you know, a crazy time in my hometown, the lawnmower salesman, the lawnmowers, you know, because America's great. And, you come out of the sidetrap tap, you see, and like, and just rambles for a bit, but then it kind of turns into like a genial message and it never really had to do with reality. It was just winging it for NPR. Like, I think that there's some commonalities here.
I wonder, as the primary on the Republican side seems like it might be winding down faster than we would have expected before it's even begun. But if that is the case and we begin to focus on a 1v1, whether or not the age part of Biden is something that does wear that maybe the people around him assume this is 2020 again, where you can put him in the basement, but are the American people cool with that? They were cool with it when everybody was in the basement. Then it was an identifying factor that he cared in a way that Trump didn't. But now I don't know, man, he's doddering. Like even when you look at the commercials that they put out, like he's slurring in the commercial. They can't get clean audio for him in the ads about the economy. He's doesn't sound crisp. You know where I think all of his lucidity was? In his little jowls that he got facelifted out. He used to have those those jowls, man. I bring them back.
More jowls, vote Joe.
More jowls. Patreon.com/we're not wrong is where you can fill our jowls with silver coins. On this Patreon episode, we are going to be talking about Try That in a Small Town, The Rich Men North of Richmond, the new wave of message country music, and exactly what it means. It is all discussed exclusively for you, the patrons, at patreon.com/we're not wrong, posted at the same time that we post this episode, so you can get three segments of this program. And somebody on our Patreon asked, hey, is there any way that I could listen to these episodes, these bonus episodes, on the podcast player of my choice? And the answer there is, of course, friends. Of course you can. All you have to do is head on over to Patreon, get your custom RSS feed, you put that in the podcast player of your choice, and you never have to worry about signing into Patreon ever again if you don't want. It'll just keep loading into that podcatcher. Bada bing, bang, boom. Listen to it straight through. Patreon.com/we're not wrong. That first GOP debate of the 2024 primary season is taking place tonight as we record this Wednesday. There are only two scheduled thus far, with a few more possibly on the horizon. And the far and away frontrunner Donald Trump will not take part tonight. Instead, he will spend today posting an interview with Tucker Carlson on Wednesday, and Thursday being indicted by Fani Willis of the Fulton County Prosecutor District Attorney's Office. That will happen on Thursday. But eight candidates will be on Fox News to debate. Nikki Haley, Chris Christie, Asa Hutchinson, Ron DeSantis, Tim Scott, Doug Burgum, Vivek Ramaswamy, and Mike Pence. Last cycle, the Democrats scheduled 12 debates, with six taking place in 2019 and six taking place in 2020. I ask you, Jen, debates, what are they good for?
The structure of these often feel useless, but at the same time, out of the eight people that are going to be on the stage tonight, most of them I'm really not that familiar with. There's like a governor from one of the Dakotas whose name
Doug Burgum.
Two of them now.
Yep. Look at politics, politics, politics over here. There's a
Vivek Ramaswamy.
Yep. I'll never pronounce that correctly.
By the way, he is in the number two podium. He has never run for office before. He has, by and large, only complimented Donald Trump, which is why he is now second in the polls over a sitting senator, two former governors, former vice president. He is doing well. Heaton.
Am I commenting on Vivek or on primaries? We're both.
Yeah, you raise your hand.
Oh, I just wanted to, Jen, please continue then. Sorry.
No, I just think that it's good for introducing, because I don't really know who these people are. I don't pay attention to politics. I do government. So I don't really know who they are. And I made a bet with you guys on Patreon last week that I don't think Trump will be the nominee. So for me, this is a real primary debate. Like, I think I have more faith in the Republican voters than to believe that they're going to want to go back to that chaos and a dude who tried to, you know, stay president despite losing. I think that will be too far for people. And he's too chicken to debate. Like, so I think this will be useful in getting the conversation started of who else could we vote for other than the ex-criminal in chief. So I think it's useful in that regard. That said, however, I don't think it's useful in the format they do it. It's a soundbite machine instead of having in-depth conversations about policy. I don't think we're ever going to get that from the Commission on Presidential Debates. I don't think we'll ever get that from any kind of platform that is controlled in any way by like corporate media or because like the Commission on Presidential Debates is basically a coup between the Democrats and Republicans to take over.
Yeah, but that is not this. They do not do this.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, debates in general, I don't like the way that they're structured. Like, I would so much rather hear a debate that's moderated by like a Joe Rogan over the course of a few hours where you're really getting into like differences in policies. And I don't think that is what we're going to get tonight, but just to figure out who the characters are and who the choices are, I am happy that this is happening.
I do want to ask you guys specifically, if you were to invent a format that you would force these people to do, what would that be? So keep that in mind, Jen. Heaton, are debates worthwhile?
They are at this point in the election cycle. The reason I raised my hand earlier was I don't know a lot about Vivek Ramaswamy, but it would be kind of cool if he got elected, because right now the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom is of Indian extract and the First Minister of Scotland's of Pakistani extract. So we'd have like the whole Britannic world would suddenly be from not white guys for, I don't know. I just thought it'd be kind of, they just have to talk about. That's what I'm thinking.
You know, hey, Tim look, Scott's running and he's getting a lot of money.
India just landed on the moon. So this is a big time.
Can you guys just like give me the backstory on who this
Vivek Ramaswamy is? A entrepreneur specifically from the medical field, but has, like many people, carved out more of a niche in the business community by railing against ESG principles. So he initially was popular with people because he was very anti-woke. He has since carved out a lane by really doing what Donald Trump did in 2016. He will be on any podcast. He will be on any television show, and he will talk for as long as people want. He will answer any questions up to and including some that got him in trouble, because now that he is on the medal stand of the top three, even if one person is far ahead, which is what Trump is right now, he made references to government transparency and used the example of 9/11, asking whether or not there were federal agents on any of the planes. He says it was a metaphor that went a little wild. The Atlantic ran it as a quote that framed it as if he were a 9/11 truther. That's gone back and forth over the last 48 hours. But what I suspect, I've got a few predictions about this debate. And at this point, a lot of people are going to hear it afterwards, so we'll find out whether or not I'm prophetic. But I believe that Vivek is prone to wild promises and pledges. I think we get at least one wild promise or pledge from Vivek during this debate. One of those like, what the hell?
Well, he sounds like a character.
I would like to watch these debates largely because I'm unfamiliar with a lot of these people too. Really, the only ones that I'm familiar with are Chris Christie and Ron DeSantis. I'm aware of Vivek, but I've not watched much. I watched like maybe half of an interview he was in one time. And then some of the other people like Aja Hutchinson, I really know very little about. And then I'll add, like, this is kind of a weird one in that I'm going to get morbid for a second. And I think if everything remains completely healthy, that the front runner will almost certainly be Donald Trump for reasons previously extolled on this program. We do have two front runners that are 80 or about 80 years old that are in an extremely punishing job. One of them's being indicted, which I have to think would probably invite some stress, particularly if you eat a lot of Big Macs and maybe you're on diet pills. So like, I can see there being a situation where a lot of the people running right now are like, it might be the front runner's not around in a little while. And so it makes sense to watch what's going on, because you could see a weird shakeup where if for health reasons, Donald Trump was unable to run for president and he decided to step down or he died or something like that, all of a sudden the metric's going to change considerably. So right now, again, if everybody that's currently running remains healthy, I think Donald Trump's going to take the Republican nomination. But I don't think that that's a foregone conclusion. And you could look at a weird thing where all of a sudden the Republicans really do have to make up their minds on the candidates other than Trump, and it could change radically. And in that capacity, I think that the debates are very useful, because right now it's like the dating game. I just kind of want to see him chat, and I just kind of want to see what rhetoric they use. I too, Jen, would love it if they sat down and gave me their policies, but I also know they're not going to do them. So I really just kind of want to know what is your personality oriented at? Like what flavor of lies are you going to tell me? And then I can pick the flavor of lies that I enjoy, and that'll be the Republican that I endorse and that I root for.
It is so funny that you guys have talked about this and how little you know of the candidates, and Mr. Lonely, who just can't get anyone to pick him out of a lineup, Mike Pence, the former vice president of the United States of America, has not even been mentioned. Just the wallpaper. He is like Arrested Development. A Milford man should neither be seen nor heard. I've been doing on PX3 debate prep. So I've been watching old debates of everybody that's going to be on stage to see how they have done in previous situations that I think this is going to be. And so I watched Mike Pence's debate for the gubernatorial race in Indiana, in which he was on stage with the libertarian candidate who was on Survivor. This man has been dogged by reality competition his entire political career. He beat a dude from Survivor to become governor of Indiana and then eventually wound up being vice president to the Apprentice host. What a truly weird career.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let me ask you this, Jen, if you were to change the format of the debate, you are now in charge. They all have to show up to and including Trump. That means there are 9 people. You can do this however you want. You can break it up into multiple events with the same format. You can put them all together at the exact same time. How would you do it?
I mean, I really would like someone like Joe Rogan. I think he'd be a good choice. He asks good questions and he's not really intimidated by these people.
But all 9 at the same time?
No, not 9 at the same time. I think we could have, I don't like the time limits on these that like they have to be in 90 minutes with commercials. Like, I feel like we can handle as the American people longer debates. And so maybe on different issues, you have 2 people go up against each other. I don't know, but I think they should be longer and people should be able to answer each other. I don't know. I just, these soundbite things, they just don't work for me. But I also like, what's the point of even saying this? Cause I don't even know how we make this happen. Like, it's just,
well, I mean, we're trying to do a podcast to entertain people right now.
No, that's the point of saying it. I haven't given this much thought because like, I don't know. It would be cool if pigs could fly, but I don't really know how to make that happen.
Good news though. Good news. This is good news. It already is happening. Joe Rogan does interview these people. Joe Rogan interviewed Bernie Sanders. He interviewed Andrew Yang. He interviewed RFK Jr. who's running for president. So many of the people you're describing are doing exactly that. And we don't have to rely on the debates for it. The debates are kind of, I like it because it's a sampler. Like, you can't figure out what sushi to get. And they're like, well, the chef's just going to sling some fish at you. And you're like, oh, look at that. I'm going to get the Reagan flavored tuna over the populist flavored tuna. But we can watch these things and there are examples where we can do that. It's not like they're exclusive.
Yeah. I guess it doesn't really have to be a debate, right? Like, I don't need to see them argue with each other. I need to know what you want to do as the chief law enforcer in the nation. And I really don't need anyone arguing with you. I need someone asking you good questions. There's a difference.
Heaton, if you were to change the format, how would you change it?
I'm going to start with the presidential debate and work backwards. So with presidential debate, everything Jen said about being co-opted by the parties, yes, it ought to go back to the League of Women Voters. Noting that I am not interested in watching a highly choreographed kabuki theater of candidates spout out poll-tested catchphrases. That does not have appeal to me. By the time we get to the presidential debates, I don't think I've learned anything. I watched all of the debates in the last cycle, all of the debates in the previous one at the presidential level. The needle did not change for me because I already knew these characters so well. And they're back there doing debate prep, and they've got clipboards where they say, don't say leave NATO, say go independent. That go independent sounds, but like they're doing all of that stuff, right? It's mostly a marketing gimmick. What I would really like to see is how their minds work and how they would operate procedurally as a executive. So I would have somebody pitch a scenario to the president, excuse me, presidential candidate, and go, how would you deal with this? So I don't, theoretically, a freighter is coming into U.S. water. It might have a radiation signature. There's something anomalous about it. It's not responding to the radio. How would you handle this situation? And just walk us through what the next few minutes would look like. And the guy would go, I would convene the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or I would immediately, I'd call my expert on radiation signatures. Fuck it. I'd shoot it right out of the water. I'm not even going to think about it. Don't fuck with America. Whatever that thing is, I'd love to know how they're going to deal with it. I'd like to know I think if you're actually giving them scenarios rather than debate topics they've prepped for, you might actually have to see them think on the spot, which is more valuable to me as a voter at this point than whether they're going to, which bumper sticker they think is going to go best. So I would like something like that. I would like almost like a war room scenario, like a dueling war room scenario.
Yeah.
And then for the debate itself, like, I mean, we do have, I'm more on the policy side, but the Democratic and Republican parties do put out a platform that oftentimes extols their signature policies. So we can read that. Again, I think it's almost like an ecclesiastical operation of just, you know, what would we like if we had all power? Maybe a situation where, I don't know, instead of having this like television dominated format, something where they could write something and then the other one could respond to it. I don't know, some kind of interactive web text. I don't know.
So like a silent auction, but for policy positions.
Yeah. But again, I think very few people are voting based on policy. And so
yes.
if they're going to keep doing the debates.
And that sounds as boring as watching paint dry.
Yeah. Yeah. In terms of
they wouldn't write it, which is the other thing.
In terms of the primaries, I don't know that I even want debates. Like, I don't think the president's job is to debate people. The president's job's not to win arguments. Like, that's just not a big, I don't vote for a guy because I think he, as much as I love somebody that can have a thesis statement with coherent, rational arguments, that's not the point of the job. So if somebody just licks the floor with the other candidates, that I don't know that that's going to make them good in my book. Licks the floor with them. Licks the floor with them.
Another hedonism. God, so, these are just fucking manna from heaven. Yeah, yeah. Licks the floor.
Licks the floor.
So I would almost treat it like, improv is going too far here. You're just giving them a prompt. Like when you're meeting people, you know, randomly at a dinner or a party or something, you know, like what's something fun you've been up to this week? Like, I wouldn't do that, but that kind of thing, an open-ended thing where they can take it where they're going, because this is really just a date with potential voters. You're almost doing like a dating show.
Yes.
You know what? Actually, that's what I want. I want a dating show like The Bachelor. I want it to be that.
Yeah. I want to go back to your initial statement and say that every debate, especially when there's nine people on stage, should begin with zip, zap, zop and then just devolve into other improv exercises.
That would be great. I would love that.
I would like for this reality show to be like 90 day candidacy, so we don't have to talk about this in summer of 2023 for an election that's not for over a year. Like, I would like to compact this.
Some of us are trying to make a living.
More than we
Shut
do.
Up. That's blasphemous.
Well, here's the thing. Like, we keep talking.
I don't come into your podcast and tell you cancel Congress. All right. I'm respecting your ability to make a living. Can we please let me make a living here? I need this for a year and a half. This is money time, baby.
Well, Congress has canceled itself. They haven't been in session for a very long time, and they're still not coming back for like another month. So
they do love their vacations. Can I give you guys a framework to understand these a little bit better?
Please do.
Or at least what I have come to understand them as.
Understand what? The debates?
The debates. Yeah.
Okay.
Television debates are not real debates. They're not Soho forums. They're not Lincoln Douglas debates. They do not really abide by the rules of them. If anything, the rules that are given are often kind of made to be broken. Candidates that obey by them are looked at as weak. Candidates that break them are looked at as strong. They are ways in which you are introducing yourself to an audience that by and large does not pay attention to politics in the way that we do. Even Jen, somebody that you have rightly professed that you do not care and you would prefer for this to be back like it was in the 50s and 60s, where in general, the presidential campaign only really started at Labor Day before, an election year.
Yeah.
This is a way for that. You are dialed in more than most people. And so this is a way for people, at least right now for the debate tonight, for Republican primary voters to be introduced to these candidates. And thus these are competitive television political commercials. If you think about it as a competitive television commercial off, where you are looking down the barrel of the camera, you are not looking at your other candidates, you are doing it, and then other candidates have a chance to ruin your commercial before they start their commercial. That's the way that I have best been able to describe this art form to people and have them not be frustrated that it's not something else.
This makes a lot of sense to me. So Justin, I've been fortunate enough to be a semi-frequent guest on one of your other shows, Great Night. And when I first started coming on and doing games with you and Brian, Brian was complimentary to me when I came off, because he's like, you get it. You understood what you were supposed to do. And I was like, right. The point of this game was not for me to win the game. The point of this game was for me to be funny for everybody watching. The actual score was very irrelevant to what we're entertainers on stage. This is just the playground that we're being funny in. The points are immaterial. This is the same thing. This makes total sense to me. This is a competitive commercial, a competitive free commercial at the beginning of the campaign process.
Which is why Trump was really good at it and is really good at it when it's a lot of people, some of whom don't matter. Because when you imagine that Asa Hutchinson was doing a commercial and he was saying, as governor of Arkansas, we raised the bottom 10% out of poverty and we cut regulations and we made small businesses strong. If Trump then goes, imagine if that were a commercial, if Asa Hutchinson, instead of him being on stage, it was him in a pastoral setting and you had the music playing. And then all of a sudden, Donald Trump just made a mouth fart at the end of it. You would assume that it's a very funny commercial and that Donald Trump was the funnier person and therefore he would have won that exchange. That is the lesson of these. It has been the lesson of these since the first one with Nixon versus Kennedy in 1960. The person that realized that this was a direct conversation with the television audience, not the studio audience, the television audience, is always the winner. And anything past that is really just technique of being able to effectively pivot to what you want to talk about and give the best possible impression of not only your personality, but also drive and whatever else that binds you to the electorate.
Your analysis is spot on. I just can't help but be extremely frustrated with that. This is an extremely stupid way to pick our commander in chief and the person who's going to be in charge of choosing who all our highest law enforcers are. Like, this is just such a dumb process and it doesn't help us take this seriously. And it's accepted as so normal and okay by everyone that I feel like I'm just very frustrated with the whole thing. It's not useful. I think it dumbs down this process, which should be more serious than it is. Like, you know, the fact that like Trump is considered the winner for going on stage, like no wonder we feel like our country is in so much trouble. Like, this is how we are doing a very serious thing. This is a job application process and we are treating it with less seriousness than The Bachelor. It's just, I hate it, man. It's very frustrating.
I will defend debates for a second. I think that they are among the more colorful ways that we decide things, but I don't think that they are, even though they're one of the few things that move the needle in terms of public perception of candidates, I don't think that they are determinative, nor do I think that they are degenerative to the process itself.
But they're dumb. Like, I think debates themselves could be fine, but you know that these questions are going to be designed to get them to like fight with each other, to like get the zingers out. It's become a production. It's become a show. It's become a commercial. This is not something that's helping us pick the commander in chief. This is, like you said, like it's entertainment now. And this isn't supposed to be something that's just entertaining. It's not supposed to be 90 Day Fiance or The Bachelor. Like, this is something that affects us directly. And I just think that it's such a spectacle. And I think that's one of the reasons why the American people just find it gross. It's why I find it gross.
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of people don't watch it, so they don't think of it at all. But that doesn't mean that they find it
gross.
That's
why I think it hurts our democracy, because people find it gross and they turn it off.
It doesn't hurt our democracy to see candidates under pressure and how they respond to it. I don't think that it hurts our democracy. We could say that it doesn't have a nutritious value.
But the way that it turns people off is harmful to us. I think serious people don't like politics because it's an unserious process at this point, because it's become this silly. So I do think it hurts us. I think we would take the process more seriously if it was presented in a more serious manner.
I think that you are longing for a day that did not exist where it was quote unquote more serious.
Well, maybe I'm longing for a future that we maybe could create if we didn't accept this as normal.
I think if you're going to have the world of politics be one of attention, glamour, and power, you're going to attract people that like attention, glamour, and power. And you're probably going to see some variation of this. If you want to not have that, make politics itself not glamorous or powerful, like drop it down to Swiss cantons, and you'll find that it'll be a bunch of bureaucrats that are fairly cold blooded. I'm fine with that, by the way. That sounds great to me. Let's have like, I think it'd be great if we lived in a country where people couldn't remember the name of the president. That would be terrific.
I don't know if that's the goal either. I just know that this process, the commercials instead of real debates and the zingers instead of policy, I don't think it's helpful. And I don't know. I don't know what else to say about it other than I find it all gross. And yeah, that's all I got.
Ew. You can just end with an ew.
Ew.
Well, look, I'm going to stand up for the people that like these things. Cause I like these things. I do think that it's important. It's important to see people. It's important to see people under pressure. That they are for whatever you can say about these things. And I don't think that they are true reflections as if that would be the number one way that we've always selected a president is to put them in a holodeck and pretend run them in a simulation 10,000 times and find out which was the best possible president. I don't think we've ever done that. I don't necessarily think that this is the greatest way to determine a leader, but I do think that it is a way to show people under pressure. This is not an easy thing to do, to come across as likable and charismatic and willing to lead the country on live television while seven other people are trying to ruin your day. And, you know, we talked about Vivek Ramaswamy. One of the things that I do believe is going to happen is right now he's polling very high. He's going to have probably three or four people up to and including Chris Christie trying to take him out, because if they can't take him out, then they have no shot at anybody else because he's the least experienced. That's going to tell you something. It's going to tell you something about how he handles that amount of pressure, because no matter what happens on that stage, it's not going to be near the amount of pressure that you face when you're president, when you have the media that is scrutinizing you, when you have other people in your party that are trying to either buffet you or tear you down or curry favor so they can move their career forward. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in this process, and putting pressure on public people, I don't think is degenerative to our process.
I just think it's a different kind of pressure than the job's going to demand. Like, I think that's how we end up with an immoral reality TV show housed as the president of the United States, because this process really does reward being charismatic and witty. And that's not really what we need for someone who's going to decide where we go to war and, you know, trying to push the legislation and try and do smart regulation. And it's a different job. And so if you are the winner of this process, I don't think that it necessarily means that you're the best person for the job you're trying out for. That's the thing. There's a mismatch. So yeah, you're seeing someone under pressure, but it's not the same kind. It's like the skills that you're testing for here, that you're seeing if they've honed, they're skills for Hollywood, not for management of the United States. I just don't think it's a great process for picking this job.
I agree. There is a mismatch. But I'm strained to think of what we would use that would replace it. I don't know what we would replace it with. We're talking about
a panel with Joe Rogan.
Great.
That would be better.
That would be terrific. But again, we have that now. Like, Joe Rogan will interview any of these people. He's probably interviewed Vivek Ramaswamy already, I bet. All of that's good. So, I mean, one of the fundamental problems we're dealing with is that we're all political nerds that want to pay attention to this. Most people aren't. And that's fine. Like, the way that we made our government was that not everyone in the country has to be constantly political, which sounds like a goddamn nightmare. If everybody had to constantly brief themselves on politics, the whole point of it is you don't have to. You can go live your life and do your job and hang out with your family and ideally elect somebody that is reasonably competent that you think aligns with your interest to go do it on your behalf. We have a delegative system. When we have a mass election where we all are now involved in it, I think with a mass election where you're reaching millions and millions of people that normally aren't caring about it, it's going to have some element of mass appeal to it, which means it's going to have a touch of that. It's not going to be treated like an ordination process to the priesthood. It's going to be about appealing to the masses.
A touch of it is one thing. Having it be what it is, these manufactured commercials, that's different. Like, I understand that the president will probably need some kind of charisma, but we really just seem to be electing people based on personality because of the way that these candidates are introduced to us. And I think these debates are a part of it. Now, would I rather have them than not? I mean, if this is the only thing we get and the other option is not knowing who these people are at all, I think that's worse. So it's better than nothing, but the structure of these things, they're not going to tell me. I mean, the decisions that these people make, like, I would like to have questions that I think something like you would write, Andrew, something that's more of, okay, here's the scenario. What would you do? As opposed to, you know, well, Ron DeSantis said this the other day. Do you have a response? Like, it's, we're getting personalities fighting each other instead of, you know, what would you do as commander in chief? And we haven't even seen the debates yet, but we've all seen them over and over again. I think the moderators are a problem. The fact that it's corporate media deciding who's on the stage, like, that's a problem.
It's not corporate media that's deciding who's on the stage.
Oh, it's the polls in the party. Yeah. Which the party is a private organization. We have already seen they get to organize their
it's candidacies. Their primary.
It is. But that's the thing. If we have this system where we're kind of only stuck with Democrats and Republicans, I don't like that that's these two private corporate clubs that are narrowing down our candidates to two. I think on a systemic level, as a government, we should have some kind of candidacy way that isn't controlled by these private clubs that are deciding with Fox News who will be on the stage, that are ordering polls, questioning God only knows who to decide who's going to be up there. Like, it's all such a black box that we're not participating in. We kind of get the final say in this, but there is no Democratic primary this year. So all we really have is the Republicans.
We have a Democratic president. Yeah.
Well, yeah. So we're really looking at, you either have Biden or whoever this other private club decides to choose. It's the system from top to bottom is just not serving us well. And I think these debates are just one tiny symptom of just the whole system being controlled by these private clubs that most of us hate.
I'm glad that you were able to get your polling flat earther take of the week off during this segment.
You know what? The polls are irritating too. We're being told that Trump and
What are they hiding? What are they hiding? Polls aren't real.
In 2016, Trump didn't have a chance. And now in 2024, it is Trump is inevitable. Like, it's, stop telling us what has already happened. Like,
he was leading in the polls for most of 2016. People were assuming
Hillary had it in the bag.
Who's we?
The world. The polls were saying that Hillary had it. And that's why a lot of people assume.
I'm not going to convince you that polls are real. You are a polls aren't real person.
I didn't say they're not
you
real.
You are a polling flat earther. It's fine.
They are determining far too much. We are being told this election polls is pretty much real. Over. The primary's done. Trump's got it in the bag.
Like, he's got a statistical lead. I don't know what, I know you're anti-numbers, but like, I don't know what else to tell you. I don't know why this is an adversarial take to say that there is public opinion polling and it shows what the numbers show right now.
Because the primary happens when we actually vote. I'm getting very sick of being told that it's already over when no one has voted.
I don't know how many times I have to say that the polling.
Oh, get ready, kid, because we have another year and a half of this.
Yes. And I'm too messent already. And I hope I only continue to nurse this boner until next fall, because I want to make a lot of money covering this because people are fascinated by it. As far as the polls go, they are a picture of the electorate right now. Not to say that they are determinative of what's going to eventually happen. If you believe that they are suppressive or not you know, in any way factually accurate. That's your opinion. But I do think that they have a place at the table. Beyond that, you can go ahead and watch the debate and let us know what you guys think at we'renotwrongpod@gmail.com. Again and again and again, we'renotwrongpod@gmail.com. Dangling Earpiece writes, a Mises is the opposite of a Aleppo.
It made me smile. That's a good Libertarian Party pun. Good job, listener.
I don't know what either of those words are.
It's for like 10 people.
It's like for 10 people, yeah.
They are all giggling.
But he just wanted to be laughed, yeah.
Snap Analysis writes, listening to jury and Briney throw down on the RICO indictment was all the hype. My takeaway, Jen, if an existing law doesn't fit perfectly to charge an obvious crime, hold it up to a funhouse mirror till it fits because consequences are needed. Justin, if a law doesn't exist, it isn't a crime, no matter how wormy it is, because public perception is a consequence. But the politicians have fucked that idea up too much. And damn it, I'm just pissed off. And Heaton, sipping Earl Grey tea, just waiting to hear the word zoning.
Is that supposed to be like what I said? Because
I think it was kind of supposed to be a joke.
Oh,
on my end.
Maybe we should take a poll and see if it was funny.
Well, I don't know. I think it's very clearly a crime to forge documents, so I'm not fitting it in somewhere. Like it's a crime. So
don't really like Earl Grey tea so much, listener. More of a Yorkshire Gold or Lap Su Shang type guy. I remained somewhat quiet because I try not to get super passionate about stuff I don't know about. And so this was last week's was a good example of that. Cause I don't know. I'd like to bring on somebody that knows RICO law. I don't though.
There's actually a great email about that. In fact, let me find it right now because it fits. We're not wrong law. The less the three of you understand a thing, in this case, RICO, the louder you yell at each other.
That's just me in general. I love bullshit arguments and they're the most fun. They're the ones I get the most passionate about. When I know what I'm talking about, I get very slow and measured with my words. But man, you want to talk about aliens or like if the moon landing was real, like we're going to get to the yelly place and I'm going to enjoy it.
Strategic primary voting. And I'm going to note here that Heaton needs to answer this question without advocating for voting reform that isn't on the ballot.
Okay.
We go now to the email. I don't like the Republican Party. I don't like the Democratic Party either. I'm fairly progressive and I tend to vote straight Democrat because generally they tend to vote for things that I generally support. But I live in Utah. So basically the only vote that really matters is the Republican primaries. Do I need to join that frickin' party in order to have my vote mean anything? Are the parties getting so far right and left, cough, 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 because only the crazies that are the furthest right and left are actually voting in the primaries and moderates have all quit in disgust?
Great question. I very much enjoyed this. I think you need to ask yourself a question, which is voting a sacrament that you're participating in that communes with a greater body and states your beliefs to the universe, or is it a procedural mechanism to try and get things moved in the direction you want? That's what you need to figure out. I think a lot of people view it as a sacrament. And generally speaking, I'd say, yeah, you should. I was at Burning Man a couple of years ago and a guy, I mentioned I was in Texas and he was like, oh man, I have half a mind to move down to Texas just to help the Democrats take over, you know, with Beto O'Rourke. And I was like, well, where are you looking? I don't remember where he was, but I was like, you should just become a Republican. And he balked at it. And I was like, but like, this makes logical sense. You would have influence within the Republican Party in your state. You'd be able to vote in the primaries for whatever the sanest candidate is, so far as you're concerned. And I would posit, yeah, like if the goal of your political action is to move the needle in the direction you want, then I think that you should probably become a Republican and vote for the most sane Republican you can find.
I love this email because when I come back to Austin, I'm going to have a legit apartment this time and I'm probably going to register as a Republican and then I'll vote in the primary and then I'll switch back to decline to state. But like, I want to participate in a primary. The Democrats aren't having one. So might as well be a Republican again and then leave again.
Super Tuesday. Yeah. I think Texas votes on Super Tuesday, which is my birthday next year.
Yeah.
Utah, if I'm not mistaken, I think Utah recently implemented a state law that makes a 3-month prohibition before the election where you can switch parties. So I believe Utah is a partially closed primary where you can affiliate with a party if you're an independent, but I think they closed the gate on you 3 months before the election. So listener, be wary of that. And Jen, I don't know what Texas does, but you ought to look into that because it might be a thing where you can't register up till.
Well, I'll be there in October.
Yeah, she's got time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Actual voting reforms writes, I just want to pitch two voting reforms that are not ranked choice voting. Number one, voting no. People should be allowed to choose to vote against the candidate if they don't want to vote for one. This would be a negative vote for whichever candidate has the most positive votes wins the electors. I think this would force the parties to put positive candidates instead of relying on other parties' unpopular old dude. And voting reform number two, IPA drinkers get two votes. They deserve it. Okay. Jen, why are you so seriously critical of IPA drinkers?
Because Joe likes them. My husband drinks them and I think they're gross. And like when I would go in the fridge and get a beer and I'd be like, what is this bitter garbage beer? Like it would just irritate me.
You keep fighting with people online about saying that you're joking about your IPA.
I don't care what they drink. I don't give a shit. I just think that they taste bad.
Listener, you've described in kind of negative terms what's oftentimes called approval voting, which has a lot of support within political scientists who study electoral reform. My friend Andrea Jones Roy is a big fan of approval voting and regularly berates me for my support of ranked choice voting because, as they will point out, all good and intelligent people support approval voting. Apparently, when you work out the math and everything, it's supposed to be a terrific way to do it. Another one would be like, I think would be really interesting, although you get into all sorts of trouble with it, would be none of the above. I would have a none of the above option that would have no lawful effect to it. But if you want to just put none of the above on, you could. That way politicians can never claim bullshit about how they've got a mandate. Or alternately, just have everybody that didn't vote be included as a none of the above option. That way we could say somebody won with 37% of the electorate. And as per usual, we should have open primaries and ranked choice voting. But I'd take approval voting too.
He got it in. He got it in, folks. I did my best. Sonoma resident / fire home insurance expert writes, in the 2017 fires that wiped out hundreds of houses in Sonoma County, FEMA came in and was able to lessen the sting and financial burden for those who lost their homes. However, one constant remained throughout the entire process, the amount of homeowners insurance. It is very interesting driving through that new section of Santa Rosa that has been rebuilt. You can see where people either, one, had enough insurance to get their house back to the way it was, two, had good insurance and had money to spare so they could make their house better than it was, or three, did not have enough insurance to rebuild and it made fiscal sense to bail out. Obviously, this is in reference to the Maui fire. Jen, we actually got another email that led you to want to talk more about this. So the floor is yours on Maui.
I'd actually like to make it a segment. I have a lot to say about it now that we're finding out more details. But as for like the homeowner stuff, like I go back to what I said last week. Like I'm definitely concerned, as are locals, that people are going to take advantage of this gap in funding that the Lahaina residents are going to have and try and take their land and do it on pennies on the dollar and just change Lahaina from what it used to be to some, you know, new playground for the corporations and the rich and the tourists. This emailer really did nail the three options, right? Like you either have enough money that you can rebuild, whether it's homeowners or insurance or whatever you have it, or you have to sell your land. And, there was a fire here in Colorado a couple of years ago, and I was here not long after it happened. And I was walking around the new development. Some of the plots were being rebuilt very, very quickly. But there were a lot of for sale signs. And so these communities, they change after something like this, obviously, but this could be a fundamental change for Lahaina. And I just really hope that the locals are able to protect Lahaina from that because it was special. We don't need a second Waikiki. But yeah, I would actually like to make this a topic because when it comes to the power lines and the sirens, I have a lot to say about the fact that the sirens didn't go off. That was insane. So yeah, if we could talk about this in another episode, I think that would be best because I have to speak on a stage. So I don't want to like we have to get through this today, unfortunately.
Eaton Sports Question of the Week. Heaton, do you think the Big Ten should rename itself? Okay. You know, after all that happened.
As I understand it, the Big Ten is a football league that has schools in it, which includes Johns Hopkins. And I infer from the email that they either lost a team or they added a team. Is that correct? Is it now like nine, but they're calling themselves a Big Team, Big Ten?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of movement after everything that happened with the Pac-12, the Apple media rights that never really came around. So, you know, ESPN factors into a lot of this, SEC network, the Longhorn network. That's a big part of it. So with shifting really landscape,
I think they should change the name. Here's the thing. What if Johns Hopkins splits in two or something and you end up getting 11 teams in it or nine teams? You don't want to look like fools. Also, I got to say, as somebody who's on the fence about watching these sporting events, I don't find the term Big Ten to be all that enrapturing. But if you had something called like the Fistlock League or the Sabretooth League, that's a league I could get. I could maybe want to go see. Are you going to watch the big game between Johns Hopkins and Illinois State over on the TV in the Sabretooth League? I'd be curious to see that. Whereas Big Ten, I'm like, that just sounds like a bunch of state schools.
All right. We need to do merch. We need to do merch. We need Polls Aren't Real, and we need Fistlock League. Fistlock League.
More hats.
More hats to you. And he's going to lick the floor with you.
Lick the floor with him.
So do you think it's appropriate for George W. Bush and Condoleezza Rice to be lobbying the Atlantic Coast Conference?
It seems like a better thing to do with their time than murdering people in the Middle East. Yeah, I think they should do that as much as they want.
Yeah, see, I think the application of RICO fits the Fulton County indictment because of the phone call to Raffensperger. When Trump made those thinly veiled threats alluding to Raffensperger that, quote, things could get very bad for you if he didn't find those extra votes. That is attempted coercion and extortion of an elected official, which is textbook mob shit per Justin's criteria.
You know what? I think that when I read things like that, a lot of the time I tend to err on ambiguity. And I'll give a less politicized example. Maybe 10 years ago now, Rob Blagojevich was sentenced to prison. And the quote that was floated, I assume there was more to the indictment than this, but the bit that was quoted in the media constantly was that when Barack Obama had become president, thus vacating the Illinois Senate seat, he said this is gold, pure gold, which was interpreted as him wanting to take monetary bribes and like
to sell it.
I read that and was like, he's using it for political capital, which of course he would. Like, I can't think of a single ever where a governor has gone, I'm not going to promote one of my people. I'm not going to put in somebody that is part of my block that I want to have in it. There's always been political capital involved in these. And as much as it would be wonderful if a governor just went, I am going to truly pick the very best senator, regardless of whether they're in my party or not, or blah, blah, blah. I don't know. With Blagojevich, if that was the indictment bit, I would have gone, I think he's talking about political capital and not kickbacks. But then again, it's 10 years ago and I didn't read that case. So,
yeah. This has been my take on that call from the second it got leaked, which I remember where I was. I was in downtown Atlanta because I was covering the runoff with Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue against Ossoff and Warnock. It seemed consistent with what Donald Trump has said publicly, that he believed that there was fraud and that Raffensperger was willfully ignorant of it. But it does sound like a mobster. I will say that it's a sound alike.
Like most people remember where they were on 9/11, and Justin Robert Young remembers.
I remember
where he
the Raffensperger call.
Trump call.
Yes.
No, you I love this shit, don't you, kid?
Yes, I fucking do. I love it. I also know where I was at 9/11, so you know
that's good.
I can do it too. I can be normal too. Keeping up with the Jones Act, writes, the Jones Act hurts Hawaii more than any other place by discouraging development. Tourism is a known developmental dead end. It provides a nice floor and is easy to set up, but it doesn't encourage education or capital formation or moving up the value chain. You'll notice that tourist nations grow very slowly, like Jamaica, and no economic tigers get there via tourism. The Jones Act effectively makes Hawaii not that different from the Philippines in terms of opportunities, except with American regulations and costs.
Great point. You know what? We got a couple of emails on this. We got a really nice email from somebody in Maui, I think. I can't remember the exact thing, but was talking about how there were ecological ramifications of this, that as the Jones Act made sugarcane prohibitive from a cost perspective, fields ended up being converted into grazing land, which ended up being much more flammable. And so it had ecological ramifications to it. These are all great points. And it's worth remembering that tariffs exist to reward well-connected industries, not to promote the common good. They exist because somebody got a lobbyist in that was able to protect their industry. In this case, it's merchant marines and American ship manufacturers that are the ones benefiting from it to the detriment of everybody in the country that gets goods taken by a ship, which would be most of us. Economically, ecologically, and everything else, on top of the fact that, you know, freedom. Jones Act's dumb.
Mm-hmm. All right. Heaton, I know that this emailer is one of yours. I knew it from the second that I read it. Trump Solution writes, I propose taking a page from history and giving Trump an island. All charges against Trump are dropped in exchange for him renouncing his citizenship and becoming the first Duke of Nantucket. That's right. Trump gets to rule the newly formed Grand Duchy of Nantucket on the condition that he renounces his citizenship and that upon his death, the island reverts to Massachusetts. He gets to troll the Obamas and the Kennedys, and he gets to be a world leader with unlimited power within his own domain.
Not only do I think this is fucking awesome and very much appreciate the email, I think most Democrats would take the deal. If we went, hey, Trump can't be president. All you got to do is make Nantucket, an island that was featured in the great show Wings, a fiefdom of him until he dies, at which point it goes back to the United States. I think everybody, with the exception of people in Nantucket, would take this deal. This sounds great.
This would be the ultimate NIMBY test.
Yes.
Like, could you convince the America's elite that live in the coastal area of Massachusetts to yimby Trump into a prison of our own making? Could you do that?
It's the best idea I've ever heard.
Could the Obamas stomach their summers being ruined by the faint sounds of Macho Man playing over the water? A mainlander in Hawaii writes, my boyfriend and I moved to Hawaii several years ago and started a roadside fruit stand. Not 1 week after we started the operation, we arrived to find 8 to 10 mongoose carcasses rotting in the tropical morning sun. We were not welcome. At the time, I barely processed what this meant and naively continued my self-serving adventurous lifestyle. But now I get how intrusive and disrespectful our little business venture was. That was by far the most overtly anti-outsider thing that we encourage, and the vast majority of interactions were incredibly generous.
Joe and I actually, so we lived in Waikiki for most of the time that we were there, but we actually thought about staying and like putting down roots. And so Joe got a real job, like not slinging pizzas. He was in the solar industry. And we moved to a part of the island that no one has ever heard of called Kahalu. And our neighbors wouldn't speak to us. Like, we couldn't make friends in our little neighborhood because we were howlies. We didn't belong there. It's different outside of Waikiki, but it did give me an appreciation of like, it made me think more about, you know, this was their island. The United States took it over, and people that look like me are kind of invading. And, but it made me feel like I'll never really feel at home here and I should leave. And it was one of the factors for why we left the island. It's a real thing.
One of the things I find really weird is there's a kind of inconsistency with we're full. So like, if you were an anti-immigrant conservative Republican living in Gristle County, Texas, and you're like, we don't want, immigrants take our jobs. We don't want them. And we don't want people from California coming here either. I'm like, well, I disagree, but it's consistent. Whereas like, I'll meet people that are like super pro immigrant. Immigrants are great. Like, you're a bigot. If you don't like immigrants, we should have more immigrants. We have way too many people in Portland. People should quit moving to Portland. We've got too many people. They're fucking up our housing estate. They should stay the fuck out of Portland. And I'm like, to me, these are the same sides of the two sides of the same coin. It's like, you know, are you open to people coming into your community on a national level or a micro level? And it's weird to me that there's a disconnect between the two for many people.
I don't know. I mean, life on Oahu, there's a lot of traffic. There's a lot of people. Like, it's an island. It is kind of full. Like, they're not wrong. Like, the cost of living is very high, and
these are they classic were there for generations.
My family was not. Yeah. I was taking a piece of housing that their kids couldn't. There is a concept of being too full.
And if those same folks are anti-immigrant in general, then I will commend them for being consistent in terms of that outlook.
Mm-hmm. Georgia secretaries of state, they're just like us. Brad Raffensperger was at South by Southwest this year, and I got to meet him while lurking outside the event with the Kind Bar founder and the Fifth Column's Camille Foster. Brad apparently has been supported by Mr. Wonka since the beginning. He seemed really personable, even outside the politics thing, and wasn't an insufferable twat. That's
Camille nice. Foster fucking came to South by Southwest and he didn't call me? That's bullshit. Bullshit. Camille Foster should have called me. You see Camille Foster, you tell him to text me next time he's in Texas.
Yeah. Well, you could have partied with Raffensperger.
Yeah, I just want to party with my old friend Camille, who I used to work with in television. I don't know why Camille doesn't want to.
See, this is what I need a bell for. I need a bell for every single time that Andrew Heaton mentions someone, whether he knows them or it's someone famous or a book that he's read that I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about, because it happens like 5 times an episode. I just don't know all the things you know.
Camille,
he licks the floor with you.
So Camille was one of the original hosts that I worked for as a television writer, along with Kennedy, who you might know from MTV, and Matt Welch from Reason. I love all of them.
I am dumb enough to know that MTV lady.
Okay, right. I love all of them. It was really, really fun working with them, and we were in the trenches together. And Matt and Camille have gone on to host, along with Michael Moynihan, The Fifth Column, that you're probably familiar with, and probably how the listener knew them.
Yes.
I'm telling you, I know nothing.
Yeah.
But it's thank a you popular for the
podcast. But like all popular podcasts, it is virtually unknown to 90% of the populace and very well known to 10. Unlike us, we're really only well known to 3. So there we go.
Like people, 3 people.
Read the Paper brings us on home. I know the jury said that the internal testing for the hack on voting machine showed about 80% of people didn't check their paper printout or didn't notice. But do you think that 20% that did catch it would lead to several people speaking up about the abnormalities? Say 20,000 ballots were affected. That would mean that 4,000 people, conservatively estimated, caught the fact that their ballot was had the wrong name on it. Maybe it's just me, but I feel that that would be enough that we would hear about it. Jen, I included this so I could ask you, because you have been a poll worker. Mm-hmm. If somebody comes up to you and says, this ballot has the wrong name on it, my assumption is that you would assume it was either user error or they wanted to change their vote because they have had a last second change of heart. Would that be what your assumption would be?
So there is a process for spoiling ballots. And so if they did want to change their vote, we could do that.
Yeah.
But if one person went back to the machine and the same thing happened, we get the same printout, and then it happened to another person and another person and another person. Like, I can tell you every single person that I've worked with in all of the states that I've been an election official with, we would freak out about this. We would call every one of our supervisors. I would call the media. It would not go unnoticed, and it's not something that any election official would just be like, oh, sorry. Like,
no,
we take it very seriously.
I don't think that it would be something that anybody would not take seriously. I do think that when we say that they might not match the name on it, the way I understand the hack, although I want to get more information on it specifically and technically, it would not always be the same thing, and it would be randomized. So you would probably, if you went back and voted, you would probably not have it happen to you again. It's not a constant thing. It would be something that would randomize throughout the day. So statistically you would get a meaningful change, but it would not be something that would be caught per se. The other element is that there is an opportunity cost for those precincts and those counties. And especially if this is a scalable countywide hack, let's say exactly that Jen is somebody that is way up on exactly what this is and sees the telltale signs of it. And she's double checking and asking everybody as they come up to scan their ballot in Georgia that they are picking exactly the names that they are doing. And she susses out that indeed this kind of malware is put on this computer. The number one, we have no idea exactly how many of these precincts are hit countywide. And two, depending on the county, you will see a tremendous push from one or both of the parties to not close those precincts. Like this is something that has resulted in tremendous anger and lawsuits. The concept, I mean, you could strategically, if let's say you wanted to depress Democratic votes in Georgia, you could theoretically, a strategy would be to run a more malicious or aggressive hack than the one that they demonstrated, with the explicit goal of getting Fulton County shut down, which is where a vast majority of Democratic votes in Georgia come from. And so they would have less election day turnout because people that came to go vote would now, I don't know, life would get in the way and some of them would just go home and not vote.
We actually had something kind of similar happen in California. It was 2006, maybe. There was a double bubble problem where people thought because of it was like a pokey ballot.
Yep.
And just the way the butterfly ballot worked, if you were voting for, I want to say it was like Dianne Feinstein, I can't remember, but you were trying to vote for a Democrat and you would accidentally vote for like an independent. I can't remember exactly what it was, but when I voted, I did it. So yeah. I felt like my vote didn't count. So I went back to my precincts and I voted pretty early that day. I told them about this. I told them that it was happening online. They called the other precincts. I personally went to 5 other ones to warn them. And what happened is they didn't shut down these precincts, but instead every single person, when they got their ballot, they were told, okay, this is a confusing ballot. This is how it works. And so I do think that if something like this were to happen, if I was aware that people's printouts were not matching, because you're right, like maybe one person goes and votes again and it's fine the second time, but yeah, it's the number of people. If I'm getting this happen to more than one person, I'm pretty sure that all of the election workers would be like, okay, we need to take down the names of every single person that this happens to. We would have detailed records. We would tell every single person when they check in, listen, there's something weird going on here today. You have to make sure your printout is correct. Like the election officials would do their best to keep that precinct open and document every single thing that happens. That's how I think that it would go down. I don't think that they would close. That would never, I mean, just can't imagine any scenario where we would shut the doors because we're not legally allowed to.
Polling places have closed down or been delayed to the point where you have gigantic lines that stretch out and depress voting for less.
Yeah. And so, but I don't think that's because I think these machines are a problem. I think having weird ballots are a problem. I think pen and paper, that's what we should be doing. And a lot of the times when these precincts are opening late, it's because the stupid machines aren't working properly. So I think paper ballots is the solution to all of this. That's what we should be advocating for. But while we do have these,
cheat the old fashioned way.
I think it's the election officials.
Put cheating in the hands of people who stuff ballot boxes and out of the hands of the hackers.
Well, I mean, I think there's ways to make that not happen too. You don't need a machine to use a Bic pen and a piece of paper. You can use Scantrons. You can have people watching to make sure that ballots aren't stuffed. Like we can record everything. We can have video cameras everywhere. There's ways to do this, but the machines have been a problem for decades now. And we're talking once again about how you went to a hacking conference and proved that there are problems. So,
well, what people have written in is that this hack is not feasible, and that you have made that argument that this would have been caught, or if this were used, it would have been caught.
But then, what do we do? Do we hold the election again the next day? Like the problem is still the problem.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's still a problem.
I am fine with the machines. All I'm saying is fucking patch them, because there are solutions to this. You are never going to be totally secure, even in a pen and paper ballot election. You're never going to be totally secure. You can just be the best that you possibly can be to process as many votes as possible.
I just want to clarify, because there was a lot of technical terms zipping around there. The original point, or at least the point you got to, Justin, was not that the actual votes themselves would be altered, but rather enough error would enter the system to delay votes. And thus, if you targeted specific districts you knew leaned Democrat or knew leaned Republican, you could end up getting those people not to participate in it because of the lines. Was that the concern?
A lot of the criticism that I got over the last week via email was that in the report, it said, because you were changing both the information with the QR code, that's the day of stuff, and the names that are listed on the ballot, which is what would be used for a hand recount, that you would effectively be changing the election with no traceable way to find that these votes were changed. And when the researchers ran dummy elections with this malicious hack in place, they found that 80% of people did not catch that the names on the slip were different than the names that they had entered in for the vote. And so many people took that to mean, okay, well, that 20% would be enough to raise alarm bells that would make this hack not feasible, that election workers or poll workers would know that something was amiss and would put the brakes on. My point, first and foremost, is 80% is a lot, and 20%, we are now filtering down to 20% of people that notice that are going to say something, or if it's an issue that they are going to notice, maybe they just want to get the hell out. They're just done with it. My assumption, I've never been a poll worker, but my assumption is that the vast majority of people that say, I need to change my ballot, this didn't come out the right way, it will be assumed as somebody who either wants to change their ballot or who wants to, or somebody that had human error on these machines, which are not particularly user-friendly. So that's my thought. And then the next level of it would be if I wanted to actually just shut down a county potentially that had a predominantly one party's votes, you could run a very malicious hack that was designed to be caught. So lines would be longer and potentially you would have disruption in a place where more votes would come in for one party.
Thank you for the clarification. Quick question for Jen. Polling precincts, it's standard operating procedure for there to be both Republican and Democrat, and I assume independent watchers, so that they're watching each other to mitigate concerns of election malfeasance. Has this been your experience?
We're like, if they want to come in, they're allowed to, but we don't usually have people just like standing there watching us.
Okay. So I kind of thought that there was a Republican and a Democrat that was there. But it's just kind of volunteers and there are optional watchers.
It's me and like a bunch of elderly people eating snacks. It's much more wholesome and very not contentious. Like, and the thing is, like, you're working in your own community. So it's your neighbors coming in, you know, like you're giving the sticker to the kids, and it's just not, no one's really all that concerned outside of, you know, South Florida.
Hey, we have breaking news as we sign off here. New York Times is reporting a fatal plane crash that contained Evgeny Prigozhin of the Wagner Group that rose up against Putin earlier this year. Who could have seen that coming?
Crazy coincidence. He died in a plane crash after he avoided being killed by Putin. What an unlucky guy. Putin didn't kill him, and then he died in an unrelated plane crash. God, that's,
it's like Ray on your wedding day.
Oh my God.
We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg on the politics program. Get my debate night set up, including all my predictions and my definitive power ranking. DeSantis is at number 2. Who's at number 1? Spoiler, it's Nikki Haley. And I'll explain to you why on PX3, as well as my recap of the events that will be out on Friday. Jen, what's on the dish?
I have been so busy at this conference. Like, I thought I would be able to finish my episode and I cannot. So eventually I have an episode about junk fees, but I think I have to push it off into September. I just don't have it in me. So listen to the UFO episode. It's very popular. Go back in the back catalog.
Check that out. Eating the Orphanage. What's popping?
I am attacking the UFO thing too. Jen, I listened to and very much enjoyed your episode.
You did
an amazing job, in multiple levels, but particularly of just sifting through all of that to get a really concise distillate of the testimony, which was great. I simultaneously had a science writer friend of mine reach out because he's got a film, out on, UFOs, and I merged the two and I asked him to weigh in on it. So I brought a science writer on to talk about the veracity of the claims of David Gresh. The science writer is a very, very, very incredulous in terms of the claims that were made. And I sadly am too, because I so goddamn want to believe in it, but I don't. That's Brian Dunning, for anybody that knows from the Skeptoid podcast. He joins me this week, and we are analyzing to some small bit what Arrow and ATIP and comparable programs ought to do in terms of identifying UFOs, what would be more advantageous than what they're currently doing, but to a great extent going through and looking at how testimonies like this have played out in Congress and the likely veracity when looking at it with a scientific lens. So that's on the Political Orphanage this week.
Fantastic. Well, friends, for this podcast, I'm Justin Robert Young. For Jen Briney and Andrew Heaton, one final reminder that we're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.